Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Here on the Aerospace Advantage, we speak with a range of experts to explore the intersection between strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So if you like learning about aerospace power, you're in the right place. To our listeners, welcome back. And if it's your first time, thank you so much for joining us. And remember, if you like what you're hearing today, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast or leave a like and comment so we can keep charting the vectors that matter to you most. And with that, let's get started with the show. 2021 may be wrapping up, but there's still plenty of aerospace developments to discuss. So today we have another installment of The Rendezvous, where the Mitchell team digs into stories you've seen in the headlines. Joining us for today's discussion, we've got General David Deptula.
Hey, Slick. Good to be here.
Mark Gunzinger.
Hey, Slick.
Doug Berkey.
Hey, man. Happy Thanksgiving. Hope it was a good one.
And Chris Stone.
Hey, Slick. How you doing?
Everybody, welcome and thank you for being here today. Doug, let's get started with you. After stalling out for months, it looks like the Senate's version of the National Defense Authorization Act is headed to the floor. So what should we be looking for in this one?
Now, I appreciate that question. And you know, look, here we are end of November, and we're still debating the defense legislation. If you look at the calendar that is up on the Hill, man, it is packed. They have so many things that they have to get through before year end. And this really, really matters, because if you don't, you're stuck in these cycles called continuing resolutions. And in fact, we're in one right now because the federal budget year has already expired. We don't have the new defense bill up. And in this case, what governs a continuing resolution is really the appropriations bill, which also has to get settled out. And just to give you kind of a sense of consequences here, Senator Reid, who's the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, made a comment that if we were to be stuck in a year-long CR, it's $36 billion added cost due to inefficiencies and everything. That's $3 billion a month. That's a lot, even by Pentagon math. So moving all of these things in a timely fashion is really, really important. So if we look at the SASC's role in this, Senate Armed Services Committee, you know, what they're talking about is meeting the administration's request for $750 billion, which it agreed to do. And they actually added a further $25 billion. And the way I look at this is a really strong bipartisan support for defense. And that's in a Democratic-controlled Senate where this is occurring. And it really causes us to wonder why we're seeing the administration continue to push for an FY23 budget with major cuts in it from what we hear. But nonetheless, it's where we're at. If you look at the amendments, and that's really kind of what's up in this phase when it goes to the floor for consideration, there are over 1,000 to be considered, which is a lot. A few of them of note, you know, a lot of them looked how to reprogram money that was slated for Afghanistan, and that makes sense, got it. Senator Duckworth from Illinois is looking at launching an independent commission to really investigate what went wrong over 20 years combat operations in Afghanistan. That really mirrors what we've seen in the House as well. And look, you know, we've talked about this before. I think I can speak for all of us at Mitchell. We're very supportive of this. We can never throw our forces into an impossible situation like that. And the future challenges are not going to tolerate it. So we're very supportive of that. The triad modernization is a hot button one. On one hand of the equation, you've got folks that are against the triad, like Senator Markey from Massachusetts. He's looking to block all funding for the GBSD and the Mark 87-1 warhead, which goes on it, until a study is completed as to whether the Minuteman III missile can last till 2050. Okay, let's just ground this in some reality here. Those missiles are already 40 years old, and you want to extend it till 2050? That is beyond irresponsible, dangerous, and just delusional. But those are the issues that are in play right now. It shows you the scales of the debate. And yet, on the other hand, you've got members on the other side of the aisle, like Senator Hoeven from North Dakota, who's got an amendment up to block any reductions in the stockpile, you know, for the next 5 years. So again, you see both sides of this, and this is typical how it plays out. You've also got other issues in play. So, for example, it's interesting that Senators Rubio and Scott from Florida and then Senator Brown from Indiana are looking to strip language preventing the Air Force from divesting any A-10s. And you think, what the heck, the Senate actually is going to try to let the Air Force get rid of A-10s. It's nuts what's happening. Well, it's because these are F-35 states now. And they know that unless they get rid of those A-10s, there are not enough bodies, especially when it comes to maintenance personnel, and some of the other dollars tied to the program to really roll in their F-35 basing bed down. And so, again, all politics is local. And as we keep hammering, and many times we don't think people are actually hard over on a program like the A-10 or others. What they really care about is there an aircraft coming in a predictable way that they can count on. And the Air Force's credibility of saying, hey, trust me for 5 years, we'll get you something eventually, it doesn't exist. So that's what's playing out there. And then Senator Graham, Republican from South Carolina, he is seeking to remove a provision that ensures active duty will receive F-35 bed down preference, and he wants more equities for the Guard. And again, there are a lot of local issues there at play as well. Now, there's one a little bit outside of our lane, but to his credit, Senator Wicker is looking to boost shipyard funding by $25 billion. And that's great. It should be applauded. I'm for that. But here's my question. What are Air and Space Force leaders doing to see similar plus-ups in our accounts? I mean, I would argue we are in worse shape than the Navy. And our industrial base is equally fragile, if not worse, in some areas. So good for the Navy, but I wish we'd see some more activity like that, articulating a problem statement and driving forward to solutions on the air and space side. There's another issue here to highlight, and this is outside of the SASC, but it's playing out on the Hill right now. In the Appropriations Committee, there's actually language currently in the bill that really pulls money from a lot of F-35 upgrades, specifically software development money for Block 4, which is obviously the next iteration we really, really need to get. And this speaks to behavior that we oftentimes see in the Hill that is incredibly counterproductive. They will pull the money, largely as punishment, and yet next year when the program is delayed and off track, they're angry about it. Well, guys, this is a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Why are we doing this? It's nuts. Are we happy where the F-35 is? No, of course not. But you don't pull money for it when it's starting to turn the corner here and get healthy in some key areas and gain momentum. That's kind of like, you know, saying I'm going to withhold money from my contractor when he's 3/4 of the way reshingling my roof. Why would you do this? So things are playing out, different committee and SASC, but again, it's topical right now.
Well, Doug, that's a huge laundry list. Now, what does everybody else think?
First, thanks for that rundown on specifics, Doug. Let me get this back to a macro level. For the audience, continuing resolutions disrupt major exercises and training events. They impede readiness. They delay maintenance. They impose uncertainty on the workforce, curtail hiring and recruitment actions, and frankly, induce inefficient and constrained contracting practices. Other than that, they also fundamentally reflect very poorly on a Congress that candidly has lost touch with the priorities established in the Constitution for it to execute. In that regard, and again, this is pretty macro, but let me remind our audience that the preamble of the Constitution states that we formed our government in part to, quote, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, unquote. However, today, Congress is acting like the terms provide and promote are reversed. And Doug, you just hit a couple of the points that have a significant impact on our nation's defense. And the Congress and the American people simply need to get their priorities straight. Otherwise, we're going to face some very significant negative consequences in the not too distant future.
I think the other thing that was mentioned about Senator Hovind's trying to block reductions of delivery systems, especially ICBM, since he's in North Dakota. As a former missile guy, I know that when we did a lot of our downsizing in the early 90s, it was because of the Russians, and it was a bipolar, soon-to-be unipolar situation. Now that we've got multiple great powers with expanding nuclear arsenals and missile systems, the whole idea of having the right numbers is even more important than it was even back in the day, because we had over 1,000 ICBMs at one point. Now we're down to about 400, and there's people wanting to shrink it down even more. And the idea is to have enough to retaliate against whoever attacked you and still have some left over for whoever else may want to cause problems or blackmail you later on. So I can clearly see the major concern that Senator in North Dakota, Hovind, would have with that, especially with the upcoming NPR coming and a lot of other ideas about shrinking our nuclear forces more.
Yeah, that all makes sense. And Sarah, you know, I know you spent a lot of time with leadership this last week, and it is just clear that we got to get in with this funding. Yeah, so they got a predictable baseline. So appreciate everybody's thoughts on this.
Okay, Chris, over to you. Seems like we can't catch a break. If things weren't bad enough with the Chinese launch of the fractional orbital strike system, we now have the Russians blowing up a satellite, filling several orbits with thousands of fragments of debris, and even the crew on the International Space Station were at risk. Now, thinking of this debris as like a ton of bullets speeding at thousands of miles an hour, if it hit a satellite or even the ISS, the results would be really bad or even catastrophic. So first and foremost, what is an ASAT strike?
Well, first, an anti-satellite weapon or ASAT strike is where a missile system is modified to conduct a hit-to-kill strike on a satellite target. And we've seen this before with China, as if they demonstrated the capability to go from low Earth orbit all the way out to geo orbit, which is about 22,000 miles away from the Earth's surface. And what it does is you launch the missile toward a point in space where the satellite will overfly in time for the missile to hit the target. So I guess one analogy for folks listening is like if you've ever been duck hunting and you have the duck flying away a bit when you try to shoot, so you have to lead the duck a little bit further where it's flying ahead of where it's going, fire the shot, and the bird essentially flies into the buckshot. So essentially that's what you have happen with this missile. Now the missile that the Russians use is what's known as the A-235 missile system, which is designed as an anti-missile system, a missile defense, as well as an anti-satellite missile system. So it's a dual purpose. And in addition to hitting satellites in the hit-to-kill mode, like we saw in this situation recently, there are publicly available information that indicates that the Russians have plans for a two-stage variant of this in the near future that will have a high explosive or nuclear warhead to shoot down hypersonic attack weapons, hypersonic orbital platforms, and even satellites in Earth orbit. So it's essentially kind of a back to the 50s approach with how they plan on handling hypersonic situations. They'll just shoot a nuclear weapon out into the area where they think that it's going to be flying through and detonate it. So in this situation, they shut down their defunct Cosmos 1408. And while the U.S. and other nations condemn the test as putting astronauts and two of their own cosmonauts at risk on the space station with the debris cloud, the Russians' response was essentially, it's really no big deal.
Okay, Chris, we got it. So why did they do it?
Well, as the Russian comments indicate, their objective was primarily one of deterrence-focused demonstration. They said that this was an example of precision strike capability of the Russian Federation as a great power capable of holding U.S. and allied targets at risk. Also, it should be noted that this satellite was pretty large in comparison with the one the Chinese and Indian shot down in their respective kinetic demonstrations a few years back. The Cosmos is a 3,860-pound electronic intelligence satellite from the late Cold War period with a radius size of about 8 feet 2 inches. So it's not a small sat, and it's not really small for that matter. So because of that, I really believe that the Russians were signaling that they could hold at risk vital intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and other systems and constellations in low Earth orbit whenever they want. And because, as we mentioned before in previous podcasts, in order to have credible deterrence, it requires three major elements. First, a weapons capability that works. They have that. Two, a way to communicate this to an adversary, in this case, a demonstration and some commentary after that of the capability. And three, the political will to use it, which they show in their response to all the debris concern and condemnation from various countries. So they clearly have all three of these elements for a credible space deterrent capability. It's just a matter of deploying it operationally.
Chris, let me jump in here on this one. You know, I think the other question is, you know, what if this is war? What are we going to do about it? What can we do about it? And to just sit there and watch these things happen and not have options ourselves is an untenable position. And this is why I agree with you so much on the need to have defensive and offensive options. Because guess what? We're living in a different world. The calculus has totally changed, and it's time that we get real. And we need to have the deterrent capability as well so that people don't do these irresponsible tests without consequences. It's unbelievable that this just happens and, you know, what, we write an angry letter? This is unacceptable.
Yeah, I'll chime in, too. It's an absolute fact that bureaucratic protests are pretty darn weak defense against these kinds of threats, and that's all we have in our quiver right now. So I'm going to preview your upcoming report just a little bit, Chris.
Okay.
We need the ability to maneuver in space, as well as active and passive defenses, hardening, and other measures to protect our space systems, our satellites, and our constellations, and so forth. we need to be able to conduct maneuvering operations in space, and that's going to take us leveraging some technologies that, frankly, are available, but we haven't done it yet.
Right. And I would also recommend, as Doug said, that we tend to treat these events like they're the first time it's ever happened. And we've had numerous events from both Russians and Chinese side where they launch an ASAT, they create some debris, people, you know, get upset, they send some strongly worded notes, they try to use international shaming, build some pressure, and the response from both of these countries have been pretty much, you know, who cares what you think, we're going to do whatever we think is in our best interest. The other thing that I think is interesting is like you mentioned, the ability to rapidly maneuver versus the maneuverability that we have right now. So I think that what we should do about it is that I think U.S. Space Command and the Space Force should leverage these events better rather than having the same talking points as the State Department. They need to highlight this as a need with Congress to match or exceed the capacity of both the Russians and the Chinese as an armed force. And around the same time as the news of the test, an article appeared in Space News, for example, that showed, oh, the U.S. Space Force has jammers that can temporarily block enemy communications. And that's great, but from a deterrence standpoint, it's pretty weak, like you were saying, Gonzo. So we need to have better communications and a better deterrent capability than just, hey, we have a reversible means and we're not going to generate debris. That's a second, third order impact that's important. But the real threat is they can range all of our stuff in space. And they're working on having the ability to go further out and with more rapidity into cislunar space. So we need to have some programs of record like the Chinese and Russians have done, take current programs of record for missile defense like Standard Missile 3 that was shown in 08 to be able to range at least low Earth orbit targets and openly deploy such capabilities to hold their own satellites at risk. And in addition, we should give, because of their linkage with nuclear weapons now and hypersonics, this shows that, like the Chinese, the Russians are not keeping their space warfighting operations distinct from nuclear warfighting and deterrence, at least not always, but could choose to combine them into some sort of hybrid strategic capability for putting together our space and other vital capabilities at risk. So I think we need to do definitely a lot more than what we're doing.
Now, let me just kind of hit this piece off, you know, just so people understand where we're coming from. We don't want anybody, including ourselves, blowing up things in space. It's incredibly counterproductive. The entire objective here is to deter that sort of action. And the adversary nations brought this into the fold. It's up to us to deter this kind of action so that we keep space peaceful. And that's a fundamental objective. We don't want some, you know, Old West shootout occurring up there.
Well, and I'll also add one more thing. There is a way to use kinetic weapons in orbit without all the debris becoming the problem. We demonstrated that in 08 when we fired the missile downward toward the target rather than just intercepting it on flight. And as a result of that, our debris has pretty much all been re-entered in the last couple of years or more. The Indians also, I believe, did something as similar to what we did, but it was the Russians and the Chinese that decided to just go bottoms-up approach into the vehicle, which scattered it. So there have been studies that show that having kinetic exchanges at low Earth orbit is not as big of a deal as, say, higher orbits, like GEO, 22,000 miles, because that would spread even more around the Earth. And because those satellites don't necessarily move, their orbits match the rotation of the Earth, that could create even more problems than some of the stuff we have based in low Earth orbit.
Yeah, plus there are a range of non-kinetic options, directed energy, electronic warfare, and so forth, that may be very hard to attribute if our satellites go dead or go blind.
Oh, yeah. If we've actually had that situation happen before with some things. And of course, you know, jamming is kind of a constant situation between commercial and states and other states. They've been jamming things pretty much normally for a while. But also keep in mind that the Chinese and the Russian view of space warfare, as they've written in their own writings, is, quote, rapid and destructive. And while we're really concerned about, you know, preventing second and third order effect, it's kind of like with the Russians in Aleppo, they really didn't care too much about keeping infrastructure open. They'll just level the place if they think it'll serve their long-term purpose or even their near-term purpose. And the same goes with the Chinese and Russians in space.
Right. And just kind of put a pin on that. The future is here. Space is now a contested environment. And I don't think anyone can argue against that.
They shouldn't.
Okay, General Deptula, the DC community is focused on risks posed by China big time, and they should be. But might this suggest we still need to consider other threats too?
Yeah, absolutely, Slick. The fact of the matter is that Security threats to the United States are growing in both complexity and numbers. Yet our combat Air Force today is about half the size that it was when we faced only one major threat, the Soviet Union. So in the simplest of reduction in logic, 30 years ago, we had a two-war strategy, but only a single major threat. Today, we have two major threats, but only one war strategy. So it is pretty simple. We need to return to a two-war strategy and corresponding capacity to execute and win in both of them. Furthermore, that capacity has to be capable across the entire spectrum of conflict, not just one element. Because as aware to this audience and perhaps more in Congress need to be aware of this fact. Aside from Russia and China, threats from a nuclear-equipped North Korea and the terrorist state of Iran are still quite significant. Organized terrorism hasn't disappeared, and cyber disruption is becoming more and more of a threat all on its own, given that we're moving toward more and more of a digital world where we rely on devices that are extraordinarily vulnerable to cyber disruption. So hopefully the new national defense strategy that's due next year in 2022 will act upon these points. But frankly, I'm concerned that it might perpetuate the myth that our strategies over the last 10, 15 years have subscribed to, and that's that we can handle a growing threat calculus with forces, concepts, and capabilities that simply won't be sufficient.
Gonzo, you recently wrote about this in your paper that outlined recommendations for the new national defense strategy. Do you mind expanding on this?
Yeah, absolutely. It's more than a matter of just throwing money at this problem. We believe DoD can have a two-war strategy, a two-war force, but it must take a different force planning approach. Today, all of our services are running to the guns, are now planning to provide forces for a major conflict with China in the Indo-Pacific. Now, a war with China is the pacing challenge for sizing and shaping all the forces, all the services, that is. But the problem is that let a thousand flowers bloom approach to force planning is creating an excessive degree of redundancy and overlap across the services and capability areas such as long-range strike, and that's wasteful. And that sub-optimizes the force as a whole. A much better approach would be for DoD to have a two-war force as a whole, not every service. And since a fight with Russia and Europe would predominantly be in the land, air, space, and cyber domains, the Army should primarily size itself for Europe. And a fight against China in the Indo-Pacific would predominantly be in the sea, air, space, and cyberspace domain, so the Navy Marine Corps should fix that as their pacing challenge. But notice I said air and space for both theaters. So the Air Force and the Space Force should size for both. They need a two-war force, since only aerospace power can go on the offensive within hours to blunt Chinese or Russian aggression.
So, Gonzo, as I understand it, General Hyten, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, stated what many of us have long suspected, that China's nuclear buildup is about gaining a first strike capability. And this ties us to an issue we've talked about during the last rendezvous, their fractional orbital strike test. So bring us up to speed. Why is General Hyten's conclusion such a big deal?
Well, I'm going to start with something I heard at STRATCOM's first post-Cold War strategic deterrence conference with their very own General Chilton, who was commander at the time. He organized that to reinvigorate thinking about nuclear deterrence. Now, one of the very first speakers was a PLA senior colonel who explained that China's nuclear deterrence strategy was simply this, and I'll quote, "If you use one nuclear weapon against China, we will use all of yours against you." Now, that fit with China's declaratory strategy that it would only use nuclear weapons to, quote, counterattack in self-defense after a nuclear strike on its homeland. So General Hyten also talked about the hundreds of new ICBM silos that China is now building, and Admiral Richard has said that that's proof that China is attempting a nuclear breakout. Plus, it's conducted several tests of a missile that can enter low Earth orbit and release a hypersonic glide vehicle carrying a nuclear warhead against, you know, any target on the face of the Earth. That glide vehicle flies at a depressed trajectory and can maneuver, which makes it very difficult to track, and we don't have the ability to defend against that threat today. So these are the kinds of characteristics you would want in a first-use weapon system that's designed to inflict a knockout blow against the United States or another opponent.
Okay, so what does it say about China's broader intent?
Well, some believe that China, still believe that China is growing its nuclear forces to enhance its ability to deter attacks on its homeland. But others, who I agree with, say that China intends to use its nuclear forces to backstop its increasingly aggressive, coercive behavior and conventional military actions in the South China Sea and against Taiwan and in other areas. At the strategic level, I believe that Beijing sees its nuclear capabilities as key to achieving its ultimate objective of, frankly, overturning a world order that's now dominated by the United States and the West. Dan, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Gonzo. So, I mean, you're spot on. And one of the things that we know and we've talked about is that China keeps developing the Shashoujian technologies, or as we call them, the Assassin's Mace, right? It's cheaper capabilities that they can use to beat a more equipped force. And so the FOBs and their nuclear weapons are one of these ways in which they can leverage a relatively small investment to deter and, if necessary, to strike and defeat a greater force, being us, the United States. And we've seen this through the ages.
Great point.
And guys, I'm not the China expert here, but you know, from what I've read on the subject, don't they also have a concept really known as active defense, which is very risky in that if they perceive a threat, they will then go on the offensive. So it doesn't mean that they were attacked. It means that they see that it might come at them, and so they're going to launch. And if you put something as destabilizing and dangerous as nukes into play, that's a really big deal.
Yes, they actually have a active form of deterrence where they kind of have what's called attack to deter kind of a mindset, where the first strike in their mind may not be an actual bomb exploding somewhere. It might be the fact that a certain force is appearing close by, or that it could become a threat, or that something may be appearing counterproductive to what they believe to be in their best interest or their homeland. So they view that as a self-defense action. But their word for deterrence, and I know Dan could say it probably better than I can, is essentially more of a coercive term than a more passive response, wait to be hit first, kind of like we've had for the last 60, 70 years.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And they actually intentionally leave the language that they use to describe it ambiguous so that they do claim that right to actively strike somebody, even if it's something that we might not consider would be worthy of escalating to war, right? They'll take that opportunity. So
yeah, it would be aggression to us, but self-defense to them.
Yeah.
So we've heard about the debate in the Senate about triad modernization. So how should General Hyten's assessment impact these conversations?
Yeah, so this is where the rubber meets the ramp. It really emphasizes why the triad remains critical to our ability to deter nuclear attacks on our homeland. Numbers still count when it comes to nuclear deterrence. Now, while orbital hypersonic weapons may be able to reach their targets even in our homeland, including our ICBM fields, those fields raise the threshold of the total number of nuclear weapons that would be needed for a first strike to knock out our triad. With our ICBMs, an enemy would have to strike over 500 missile silos and other individual targets, but without them, without those ICBMs, that could be reduced to as few as 6 targets. Now, that's pretty compelling math in anyone's book. It's compelling against moving toward a dyad or even reducing the number of operationally deployed ICBMs we have in the field. It reinforces why we should fully modernize the triad and not allow one or more legs of the triad to wither away by neglect.
Okay, the Air Force owns 2 legs of the triad, and the Space Force owns a lot of key early warning systems that inform the top decision makers about a nuclear threat. So, General Daptula, this one's for you. What should this mean for the broader Air Force budget considerations?
Well, Slick, a blaring alarm was sounded recently when the Heritage Foundation report on the status of the U.S. military was released couple of weeks ago for 2022. In that report, the rating of the Air Force fell from marginal last year to weak this year. Now, to those who follow the travails of the armed services, this slip in rating really shouldn't come as any surprise, because for the last 27 years in a row, the Department of the Air Force, which now includes the Space Force, has received less funding than either the Army or the Navy. Let me repeat that. For the last 27 years in a row, the Department of the Air Force has been at the bottom of the list in terms of service budget allocation than the Army or the Navy. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, since 9/11, the Army has received over $1 trillion more than the Air Force. Now, that's an average of over $53 billion a year more than the Air Force. So it's time now to rebalance that allocation to the Air Force to modernize and grow it out of that weak position. And this is even more appropriate today, given our recent discussion on the triad, because the Army is the one Department of Defense organization or service that's not responsible for any leg of the nuclear triad modernization. You know, you might say, well, wait a second, hadn't the Air Force been faced with this challenge for a while? Well, yeah. And its approach has been to repeatedly try to get Congress to allow it to retire its old aircraft and reduce its excess infrastructure to free up funds inside its own budget allocation to invest in modern capabilities. All of this to no avail. And frankly, now it's time for Plan B, because without congressional approval to retire its old aircraft or to close excess infrastructure, and without any significant increase in budget top line on the horizon, which I think everyone recognizes is not going to happen, what needs to happen is redistribution of the assets that the Department of Defense does possess to the services that are in the worst shape and who are the most relevant to the national defense strategy. This is the essence of jointness, ensuring that the right forces are available at the right places at the right times. Now, all that said, a strong Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Space Force, and Air Force are all required. But that balance no longer exists, with both the Space Force and the Air Force rated as weak. And that's because for over 30 years, they've sat at the bottom of the Department of Defense's funding allocation. I'll just wrap this up by reminding everyone that the current Air Force Chief of Staff coined the motto of accelerate change or lose. And the current Secretary of the Air Force has defined his top priorities as China, China, China. Without a shift in DOD resources to the Department of the Air Force soon, what the Department of Defense risks accelerating is not change, but its potential of losing to China. So I'd tell you, tell the leadership, tell the public, tell the Congress that it's time to change our slogan in the Air Force to, quote, increase the Department of the Air Force budget share or lose, unquote. Because that's what's going to happen if we continue to underfund the United States Air Force.
General Deptula, great points, no question about it. Let me put that in strategic terms. If all the Air Force can do is job one, which is modernize its two of the three legs of nuclear triad to include the B-21, and then it doesn't have the resources it needs to modernize its conventional forces, so what does that do in terms of a conflict with China? It eliminates rungs on the escalation ladder. We have the choice of, frankly, losing conventionally and escalating to nuclear conflict. That doesn't make sense. But that's what we're going to be left with if we cannot rebuild the Air Force's conventional forces.
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, recapitalizing the nuclear enterprise with the B-21, the GBSD, but then there's our geriatric fighter force structure with an average age of over 30 years for our fighters, with the F-35 We have increasing demands on the tanker force. That's why we're building the KC-46. We have training aircraft that date back to the Eisenhower administration that we're replacing with the T-7. Command and control has been in the news. So in order to achieve the joint all-domain command and control capability, each of the services working on an element, the Air Force is the advanced battle management system. And so this is not a trivial list. These are major investments that, like you say, you know, if we only fund one element, the other elements that go lacking are going to have a significant negative strategic impact on our ability to defend the nation. The other point that I'd like to emphasize is this just doesn't affect the Air Force. This affects all joint force operations because there is no joint force operation that can be conducted without some element of the Department of the Air Force being involved. You can't say that about any other service. And that's what makes the Department of the Air Force the indispensable force.
Yeah, and I'll also add from the Space Force perspective, as we mentioned numerous times on other podcasts, that with 2.5% of the defense budget, the Space Force is not anytime soon going to be able to get after a lot of the threats we talked about in this podcast, namely gaps in our sensor coverage for hypersonic weapons, highly maneuverable space systems that are also both kinetic and non-kinetic in nature, having the weapon systems necessary to be able to match escalation or to surpass and gain space superiority. We're not going to be able to provide much to the joint force outside of our standard old warfighting support mindset if we don't get more requirements and resources in order to build back up to a space force that is worthy of its name.
Yeah, I'll throw one comment in. Some people might think we're saying more money, more money, more money. I believe DoD as a whole has a budget that's sufficient to build the kind of force we need in the future if it was willing to make those cross-service, cross-domain trade-offs to optimize for the kinds of fights that we need to deter and win if we have to fight them, and simply not willing to make those kinds of trade-offs. Excessive overlap in capabilities, excessive redundancy in force structure is not going to deliver that future joint force that our nation desperately needs.
Okay, parting shots, anyone?
Well, you know, I was thinking about this while we were talking, and think about this here, guys. You've got China pushing aggressively, both in South China Sea and then Sea of Japan, and you've got Taiwan issue percolating. You've got Russian forces along their border causing some severe headaches in Europe. You've got European forces like Great Britain, for example, deploying forces there to try to check that. The withdrawal of forces from Afghanistan in a very challenged set of circumstances, to put it mildly. So that's going to cause issues downstream. Yet we're still in this zone where, you know, defense budget, we're stuck in this continuing resolution, things kind of just churn along. We don't have this many things pinging off that are this serious without eventual consequence. Something's going to happen. And so exactly what General Teptula and Chris and Gonzo are talking about in terms of making hard choices, that's got to come soon, because I think one of these things, unfortunately, is going to trip, and we've got to be ready for it. Otherwise, the consequences are going to be very severe, because we're looking at adversaries with incredibly different value sets and priorities that are fundamentally opposed to what we want for our families to live in, and our country, and our economy. The list goes on. And we got to get real about this.
Okay, that's all we have time for today, but thanks so much to all of you for sharing your thoughts. And to our guests, we hope you had a great Thanksgiving. All of our best to you and your families. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.